Hi, so thank you so much, Matt, and thank you so much for the introduction. Also to Neil and Kendrick for organizing this and having me here. What I'd like to tell you today about is based on some pieces of work we've been involved in over the last 4 or 5 years. And it's about broadly interconnecting several themes under the heading of, as you can see, looking at how we can map the baryonic universe to understand it better and to understand several interesting things and phases which offer clues into reionization, and from that epoch all the way up to present-day galaxies, which we see today. So this is a broad outline of what I'll be speaking about. I'll start with some sort of introduction. Why do we care? Why do we care about baryons and what they've been doing? What are the kinds of processes which we hope to understand, and we hope to understand better by using baryonic gas as tracers of both astrophysics and cosmology? I will move on to how we can sort of model and simulate the abundance and clustering of probably the most abundant baryon, the hydrogen, the neutral hydrogen, H1, with a halo model framework applied to all data we have today in H1. And then I'll go on to describe its formalism, the observations which I used to constrain this halo model. I'll go ahead to ask how we can use this halo model formalism to forecast future measurements for the exciting new surveys which are coming up in the next few years. It's possible to extend this to look at the carbon monoxide and C+, which are two other very interesting tracers of the interstellar medium and the intergalactic medium. And I'll end with a few prospects for how all this fits into the broad picture scheme of cosmology and reionization. So this talk will be based on the following set of papers, and broadly, the first few are the ones which introduce this halo model framework and ask how different observations of neutral hydrogen tie into each other, what kind of consistencies and inconsistencies exist between them, and how we can model them in a systematic manner. The one with Kulkarni looks at how we can connect this approach towards studies of galaxy evolution, so do something which is similar to what people did for galaxies and for HOD models. The next one looks at the forecasts and looking at how we can basically predict cosmological parameters which might be observable in future surveys and their uncertainties. And the last two are extending this approach, like I said, to other tracers, namely the carbon monoxide and C+, and understanding both the ISM and reionization. So this is an introduction which probably many people in this room don't need, but I'll still spend a couple of minutes just telling you that baryons did some exciting things during the lifetime of the universe. Specifically, they went through two major phase transitions, the first one being recombination, which we're all aware of, about 300,000 years after the Big Bang, at which the gas decoupled from the CMB, and this ushered in the period which is known as the Dark Ages, so a few hundred million years without light. So basically when the universe was dark and there were no stars, and except for the slowly fading glow of the CMB, there wasn't really any light lighting up the universe. And the end of the Dark Ages is signaled by this period called Cosmic Dawn, or people also call it Cosmic Renaissance as the end of the Dark Ages. So you can call it First Light. And this is when the first luminous sources lit up the universe, and they had their photons ionizing the intergalactic medium, which brought in the next major phase transition, the second major phase transition of almost all the baryons in the universe. So like I said, the neutral hydrogen went back into ionized hydrogen. And we know that today, for the last about billion years or so, from 1 billion to 13 billion, so the last 12 billion years, we are seeing the universe highly, highly reionized, so reionized to better than one part in 10 to the 4. So this is basically a broad picture scheme of how the universe went through these phase transitions, and especially the second major phase transition is just on the brink of observation of the future surveys. So These are the kind of future surveys which are going to be out there to map all these exciting epochs. So we know that at the epoch of reionization, we would like to map the neutral hydrogen, the kind of bubbles and the kind of structure which the neutral hydrogen was going through, the gas and the intergalactic medium. So LOFAR is one of those which is going to do it. Of course, in Canada, we have CHIME, which is going to look at the post-reionization universe. And like CHIME, there's other telescopes. This is by no means exhaustive, but this is just representative. And you have the Square Kilometer Array, which is going to come up in probably South Africa and Australia in the next few years. And then there are these experiments. The last two lines are the ones which are the experiments to map the other tracers, like CO, the CO molecule in different transitions, and the C+, which is the ionized carbon, and understand different facets of the early universe. A very novel technique which has come up in the recent past, in the recent about decade, to do all this and to connect it together is called intensity mapping. So, like the name suggests, intensity mapping is to do this. What is shown on the top is to say that you have something like a traditional galaxy survey. So you're looking at individual objects. So those red dots are just individual objects in, say, carbon monoxide, CO selected galaxies. And in intensity mapping, you just smear everything out and you say you're going to be sensitive not to individual objects, but to an integrated emission in every pixel. So you're just seeing some sort of blurred image of what you would see in a traditional galaxy survey. And intensity mapping is interesting because it allows you to explore these things very fast, and it's cheaper, and it allows you to probe different scales. So an example is in the bottom. So you see that at large scales, more like the IGM, more like the reionization kind of studies. You have bubbles, and you can see this in 21 centimeter neutral hydrogen. And at smaller scales, you can see that different other lines start showing up and getting more and more important. You have the carbon monoxide, a strong tracer of the ISM, and also the C+, another tracer of the interstellar medium. And so doing intensity mapping can potentially get you a lot of constraints into the way the detailed astrophysics, the way it behaves in different scales, and in so doing, get you constraints on cosmology and on phases like reionization. So, particularly in 21 centimeter, there is a huge effort to use this line to understand the dynamics and the abundances of gas and in so doing cosmology over a large number of epochs. So basically, in principle, you can do it all the way from the beginning of the Dark Ages to the present day, which is shown here. And what is interesting is that the number of modes you probe in 21 centimeter in general with baryons is extremely large because you're going all the way to the gene scale. So you can get much smaller scales than the CMB, so you can really get a lot of modes. And what is also interesting is that unlike the CMB, which is one surface, in these kind of studies, you have a sensitivity to many surfaces, and because every frequency, you're accessing different epochs, so you have like a 3D picture, so what's known as tomography. So you basically have something like this if you think about reionization, when the bubbles are kind of overlapping and you want to see, okay, how much is ionized, how much is neutral, and what's happening. So essentially you can see that it's something like slicing Swiss cheese. So you think about ionized bubbles during reionization, and different kinds of frequency channels will give you different epochs and see what the gas and the plasma and other things are doing at different times in 21 centimeter. So one of the things we have to keep in mind in all these studies, and especially with 21 centimeter, because people would like to use this to probe, for example, modified gravity, massive neutrinos, and large-scale effects as well, and cosmological effects, is that in any of these kind of surveys, especially in, for example, intensity mapping surveys like this, you are sensitive to what is known as the power spectrum. So you can forget about the details of this, but you would recognize these expressions as being similar to what we write down for the CMB. So you're essentially looking at the power spectrum of intensity fluctuations. So this is your delta fluctuations as a function of K and Z. And you're looking at how the power spectrum is behaving as a function of scale and also basically as a function of redshift. And this power spectrum actually splits up into two interesting components. So it always has a component which is inherently astrophysical. So it will have a sensitivity to what is known as omega H1, which is the abundance of the tracer. So here it's H1, but this can equally well be CO or C+ or any other kind of tracer. And it has a sensitivity to what is called BH1, the bias. So bias stands for essentially how the tracer is clustered with respect to the underlying dark matter. So you've got the dark matter clustering in a particular way, and this is not expected to be exactly one at all scales and at all redshifts. So you have a way to parameterize that. And the other part, of course, is cosmology. So depending on your favorite model, you can change the cosmology and explore how this kind of changes your constraints. So there is the split in astrophysics and cosmology and an interplay, which can be both a good thing and a bad thing, which I'll explain in the next few slides. It leads to something interesting, which we call the astrophysical systematic in these surveys. So this is something we need to be aware of when we are interpreting intensity mapping surveys. And broadly speaking, this is the kind of effect. So imagine we have a smooth cosmological background, which is broadly true because, for example, Planck and other surveys have measured these parameters, cosmological parameters, fairly well, and we have sort of uncertainties only at the sub-percent level or few percent level at many of these parameters. But we are looking at these cosmological parameters in all these intensity mapping surveys through the filter of astrophysical uncertainty. So we are really sensitive, we're limited by the astrophysics which goes into the molecules and the atoms which are making up the tracer, which we're observing and through which we're trying to get a handle on cosmology. So in order to quantify this effect, to understand how much the astrophysics really influences our understanding and our constraints on cosmology, we did one study where we said, okay, we're going to look at all the possible constraints which we have today, all the available constraints on this parameter, the one I introduced in one of the previous slides, called omega H1. And this parameter is constrained by several different kinds of observations. You have galaxy surveys, which are constraining the low redshift end, and then you have some intensity mapping, and then some things from absorption line studies called damped Lyman alpha systems. And what we found is that if you look at all the uncertainties we have on omega H1 today from astrophysics, it leads to almost a 60 to 100% uncertainty in the H1 power spectrum, which you'll measure from current and future experiments. So this is something like a quantification of how much it's going to limit your sensitivity to cosmology and how much you might have to bring down these astrophysical uncertainties or at least quantify them better to see how they influence some parts of the cosmological power spectrum. So we wanted to go ahead and ask how we can quantify this better and how we can efficiently model the astrophysics so that instead of just doing a statistical study of all the uncertainties in omega H1, we ask, can we model the astrophysics in a way which allows us to understand both this astrophysical systematic as well as what we'll measure from an intensity mapping survey better, right? So the HALO model, which has been used extremely successfully for both dark matter as well as galaxy clustering studies, is a very ideal tool to use for this purpose because it allows you to build up a framework which combines the intensity mapping observations with those of individual objects, which are very complementary to each other. So the HALO model has been done, has been used, you know, for decades for the dark matter clustering, for dark matter abundances, bias, and things like that. And if you want to do a HALO model framework for a tracer, then we realize that there is actually two main ingredients. There are two main sort of inputs we need to provide on top of the dark matter HALO model in order to model the tracer effectively. So the first one is called the H1 to HALO mass relation. So that's on the left here. And it tells you what's the average H1 mass, average, associated with a HALO of mass M at redshift of Z. And the other one, this rho H1 of R, you have an extra term and function, you know, an extra thing it depends on, which is R, tells you how this H1 is distributed inside that HALO. So it can be shown, and this is what we spent the first few pieces of work I described to you, showing that if you have these two ingredients, then you can basically derive all the H1 observables which we have, and which we have today in the literature, and which we hopefully will measure in upcoming observations. So what are these H1 observables? What are the kind of things we can derive from these two functional forms? At low redshifts, you have what is called, basically what I would call 21 centimeter emission surveys. So if you look at some of the galaxy surveys in 21 centimeters, so this is what is shown on the top, you have something called, for example, HiPass and WISP used to do 21 centimeter surveys at redshift of almost zero. This is a very, very optimistic band. Most people will say it stops around 0.2. So 0.2 is roughly where we can expect the edge of our observations of 21 centimeter in emission. We have to resort to other things after that. But nevertheless, these are surveys which really go and look at individual galaxies in 21 centimeter, build up luminosity functions, and build up, for example, the clustering and bias as much as they can get from these observations. And these are very different from what is on the second part, which is the 21 centimeter intensity mapping. And 21 centimeter intensity mapping is, like I told you, you just have a smeared out image rather than having individual sources. So these are very complementary to each other. And one of the pioneering studies in 21 centimeter intensity mapping did take place, led by people at CETA, Uli Penn and others, who looking at cross correlations of 21 centimeter emission with galaxy surveys. And they found they were able to get very good constraints on both the abundances and clustering of these systems. So GBT Deep 2 is a study which was taken up around redshift of 1. And this was something which was used to place constraints on how the gas abundances and clustering are changing around 0.8 to something like 1 point something. And at higher redshifts, what is interesting is that we don't have emission, we don't have intensity mapping yet, but we can get extremely good constraints on precisely the H1 bearing systems by using another line. So H1 has this Lyman alpha transition. So the Lyman alpha leads to a set of objects which is known as DLAs, damped Lyman alpha systems. And these DLAs are the biggest reservoirs of neutral hydrogen between redshift 2 and redshift of 5. So these are have been shown to contain most of the H1. And they've been measured in different surveys with different tracers. And you can see that essentially you have some things called incidents and different kinds of observations of them coming from different surveys between redshift of almost now 1.5, because they did that in the UV with the help of HST, but also stretching all the way up to 5.5. So, of course.
What scales do these surveys probe? Do they, I see they are different redshift, but do they also probe the same scales?
Up to now, yes. So right now, these are all galactic scales and, you know, sort of...
Galactic, like our galaxy scales.
About a few KPC yeah. to a few MP, maybe 1 or 2 MPC or something like that, yeah.
Okay.
So essentially, the DLAs are line-of-sight surveys. So they're going to be sensitive to the H1 reservoirs, which are believed to be proto-galaxies or progenitors of galaxies. We still don't know. That's an open question what they are. But most likely, the scales are similar to what we have in galaxies. And they're the maximum column density objects, so they hold the most H1. That's why, this is precisely why we went ahead to develop a Halo model framework which addresses all of this, because one of the things you will see is that even though observationally these are about the most different observations you can imagine, they all are sensitive to the neutral hydrogen abundance and clustering, which is an important ingredient in intensity mapping. So H1 is H1 across redshifts, no matter how it's observed. We need a theoretical model to be able to address all of it together.
So this is new to me. So the DLAs have most of the hydrogen?
That's right. Most of the hydrogen between redshift of 2 to 5. We don't have emission yet. So we have to see them in the absorption line surveys of quasars.
Okay, and what are the characteristic sizes, the masses of the DLAs, do we know?
Galactic scales. The halo masses are about 10 to the 10, so I would say the galaxy masses, absolutely. Okay. Well, at those redshifts, there are constraints on the halo masses. There are some controversies, and today we think they are between 10 to the 10, 10 to the 11, around redshift of 3 at least. So could be faint galaxies, could be proto-galaxies.
But that's not where the star formation is happening, right?
Actually, that could be sort of a progenitor to where the star formation is happening. You're right that it's not exactly where the star formation is happening, because people have imaged these objects, and they found that the star formation rates are extremely low. They're not the places of active star formation. They are believed to be faint dwarf galaxies, if they are galaxies. If they're galaxies, they're low metallicity, faint dwarf galaxies. And these are, like I said, 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10 is roughly where you'd expect those. But nevertheless, they are seen to hold a lot of neutral hydrogen. So that's it's still an open question what they are. Yes.
Why there's no 21 centimeter in
high redshifts? Yeah. Because our technology is unfortunately still not good enough to do it. Until CHIME, for example, CHIME is going to do between 0.8 and 2.5. SKA mid will do from something like from almost 0 to 3 point something. But today's technology doesn't allow you to resolve objects in 21 centimeter emission at such great distances, unfortunately. So until we have SKA, CHIME, and precursors, we will have to rely on the tracers we already have.
But actually, you are using the intensity mapping that is mirrored out image, so
that's
you don't need the very high resolution of the.
That is true. Even then, you know, there are foregrounds and systematic problems which are limiting our telescopes to go more than about point. People have tried. Well, 0.4, 0.5. But beyond that, unfortunately, it's difficult today. We have, for example, huge facilities, CHIME and SKA.
So I have a question. So it's a bit weird. So you're saying most of the neutral hydrogen is this damp system. So if I compare the neutral hydrogen damp systems to the Lyman alpha fires,
that's right.
You're saying there's more in this.
Because this is, you can see that this line is the post-reionization redshifts.
Yeah.
So it's up to redshift 6. And we know that the amount of hydrogen in the IGM, the H1 in the IGM, is 10 to the minus 4 or less. So the ionization of the IGM is so high that the Lyman alpha forest, even though there is a lot of it, contains very, very little H1. All the H1 is locked up into the dense systems which have already collapsed and sort of formed galaxies and so on, or are progenitors like the DLA systems. That's right. So this is why we decided to use a Halo model framework which has these two ingredients, which I already explained, the H1 to Halo mass and the rho. And basically, the way these are motivated has been from several people in the literature, including us, who were trying different things at different times. And the functional form for the H1 to halo mass is essentially a standard one, which is a superset of what different people have tried at different times in the literature. And you'll see that it has three parameters, main parameters. The first one is called alpha. It measures the H1 fraction relative to the cosmic H1 fraction. So you can have some up down normalization parameter. The second, beta, is called the slope. And the slope is telling you how much the H1 mass is sort of sloped with respect to, logarithmically sloped with respect to the halo mass. This turns out to be important, which I will sort of come back to in one of the concluding slides. And the third one is the lower cutoff. So lower cutoff is essentially because you can see this is a virial velocity cutoff, and observations and simulations and even analytical theory of galaxies have shown repeatedly that halos with virial velocities below a certain amount don't preferentially host H1. This essentially boils down to UV feedback inhibiting efficient cooling in these kind of halos. And you find in simulations and so, and also if you do a pen to paper calculation, that the typical number is about 30 to 35 kilometers per second in virial velocity. And so this is a form which various people have advocated to use in at different stages. And it turns out to describe many of those observations pretty well. Coming to the profile, the profile is interesting because different groups have tried to model the profile for different purposes. And in so doing, they have even got different functional forms. Some people like to use what is known as an altered NFW profile, so an NFW with a thermal core in it, which was used very popular for describing H1 in clusters and other things like that. And most people at low redshifts use something called the exponential surface density profile. And this is what we also advocate, because this is a profile which, as you can see, this is not strictly a surface exponential. If you take a surface exponential, it will become a Bessel function in 3D. But for all practical purposes and all scales of interest, a 3D exponential works as well. And you need to normalize this somewhere. So you need to define something called a scale radius. And the scale radius depends on what is called this concentration parameter, which actually is modeled just like the dark matter with two free parameters. You have a normalization and you have an evolution with redshift. So this is how the H1 profile looks, and this is how the H1 to halo mass, and you see that together there's five free parameters we should constrain with the data. It turns out we can do that, and here I show the results of a...
So that's power of 0.109.
That's right.
Where did that come from?
Okay, that actually comes from dark matter. So let me see if I can bring that up.
Right.
This actually comes from dark matter, and you're right that sometimes, you know, it's possible to keep, instead of doing this, to keep it free. But what we found is that most of the times this power is so small that it doesn't matter. And if we put it free, it sort of, you know, led to more degeneracy. So we found that more than five really caused problems with all the combination of data. And since it was so small, it was okay to keep it as 0.1.
So this assumes scale invariant spectrum, basically. Like
this assumes, sorry?
Scale invariant spectrum with density perturbations, this slope here. This comes from the NS minus one, where does this factor come from? -0.1009.
Oh, this comes from a fit, actually, to simulations.
Oh.
So people did N-body simulations of dark matter, and
so
they looked at the...
How do you know that's the right thing?
That's right. We don't know that it's minus 0.1. And what people did was to do a set of models where they tried this to DLA systems. So now there are some 12,000 DLA systems between redshift of 2 to 3 and 2 to 5. So they tried a fit to do this kind of... I mean, they actually tried to see how much freedom you have in this m by 10 to the 11 m sun. Yeah. And they found that this is okay. I mean, they found that the data didn't warrant changing that more than for the dark matter.
Yes, your mass function probably is like this.
Exactly, it's also stable. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so.
Power is not really so, I mean, also because it's minus 0.1.
And because you're also probing very close to the 10 to the 11 solar mass scale, it's not...
Yeah, exactly.
It's not a big...
The first one is so...
Yeah.
That's right. In fact, this was something people found for DLAs, ironically. They started doing this when they were modeling DLAs, and they found that this thing works very well. The only thing we brought in is we used to use this altered NFW a lot because we thought that that's the advocated profile, but people thought that, you know, H1 is like that. But we found, this is what I'm going to show you in a few minutes, that the exponential does a much better job in describing the low redshift part of the data, which you can probably understand in hindsight, but I'll come to that in a few minutes. This is the MCMC, which shows you all these constraints. And what was there were a couple of things interesting. The first was we could constrain it at all, which was gratifying, that we could constrain all these parameters to the kind of accuracies which we could with the current data. And also, we used all the data. We used the H1 galaxy, we used the DLA, we used the intensity mapping, and we found that this kind of form works. And also, we found that if you have more than 5 parameters, you lead to a lot of degeneracies. This is what I was saying. You have the data don't warrant more than 5. We were pushing the data to the limit when we tried evidences and different models. And with less than 5, we didn't fit all the data. So we found that this was like the sweet spot where all the H1 observations were coming into the Halo model framework and fit by the model.
So your concentrations are?
The concentrations are, yes.
They're pretty high for dark matter. I guess your galaxy is just much smaller than that.
So this number is like 30. And for dark matter, the corresponding number is like about 3.4. So you should remember, there's just one thing which is interesting. I know that it's usually quoted as something like 10. But that 10 is coming because if you look at the way the concentration is written, there's an extra 4 on top of that 1 plus z, right? So the 10 which most people sort of have in mind is this CH1 times 4. So the number for dark matter which corresponds to this is 3. And this is telling you that H1 is clustered about 10 times stronger than, you know, a bit. The scale radius is about 10 times inside the dark matter video, which makes sense with all the different observations we have. So something
it's
like
10 times smaller than the scale radius.
It's 10 times smaller than the virial radius of the dark matter halo.
And that's scale radius.
This, yes, exactly. So the RS,
which is not the virial radius, right?
The RS, right. So the RS, which is here, let me just get that back. Yeah, you can see this here. This RS is that thing there. And you see that the way the RS is basically the virial radius divided by the concentration. And for the RS for the dark matter will be something divided by the dark matter's concentration. And for the H1, it would be divided by the H1s. And these two differ by factor 10. So the H1 is basically concentrated to like about a few 10 kpc. That's the number which comes out of the numerical analysis. I can show you a plot in the next one where you will see. Exactly. It's basically tracing the star formation region, shall we say, and a little bit outside because that's the edge of the ISF. Yes, exactly.
So RS for Milky Way is
few 10 kpc. Few to 10. Few 10 kpc, yeah. I thought it was a few 10. Exactly. I think it was something like, I mean, it was, we found that it is very similar to galactic size. You know, the kind of scale this CH1 picks out, which I'll show in just the next plot, is very similar to where you expect the edge of a H1 galaxy. So that was again gratifying. That was not something we put in. It just came out.
Just another question. I just want to ask the type of data you're fitting. So
yes.
Is this like you're fitting the profiles of individual galaxies? I guess that's you're showing.
This is what I'm showing here. Okay, so the kind of data we are fitting is like I showed you that big schematic, which showed you the H1, 21 centimeter, the intensity, and the DLA. So I'm just giving you a snapshot here of the kind of data which is fit by the model. On the left-hand side of that vertical line, you're going to see some of the data which was already matched to the MCMC. What this is showing you is what are called column density distributions of the DLAs. These are just probability distributions of how many DLAs you're going to have per unit column density, per unit redshift. These are extremely well measured. You can see that these error bars are extremely low, and that's because they have a huge sample and they were able to do very well with the systematics and so on. So this is a huge reservoir of data which was, you know, matched to the MCMC. This is that smeared out measurement. This is the intensity mapping. And what we found is that once you have this formalism, you can model DLAs and you can model 21 centimeter and you can model intensity mapping because you also have the large scale information. So from this, you can fit all this, which is no surprise because the MCMC was fitted to this. On the right hand side, you see examples of observations which were not explicitly matched to the MCMC, but which fit out of the box. What is shown on top is what are called surface density profiles of H1. Surface density profiles are what I was alluding to a little before in the talk, when I said that the H1 at low redshifts was typically observed to be exponential disks. So they had images, they had surfaces, and they had H1 as a function of basically the sigma is the surface density, and that is shown to, I mean, there is a way by which this number changes as a function of scale. So people have worked that out. And what we found is that with the concentration parameter and its evolution and so on, which has been matched to completely different data, this kind of data, the low redshift fits right out of the box. So you see that this Bigel and Blitz, which is the kind of slope which is predicted, the error bars are pretty high. They're kind of, you know, I mean, much more than the difference between these two lines. The line is what we get, what we predict from the Halo model. So that gave us a lot of confidence in the parameters themselves because these parameters were explicitly not matched to the MCMC, but they just fit out of the box.
Sorry, where did this big alumnus come from? What is the...
A bunch of galaxies observed in 21 centimeter emission around redshift of zero and imaging. It's called blue disk. So blue disk because H1 rich galaxies.
And what is R25 there?
Oh, R25 is just a scale. It is a scale, it's some typical scale, number of 25 kilometer per, 25 kpc, something like that. It's a typical scale which they use this R25 is one of the parameters of that model, the sigma to R25. So this is, so basically if you do that and you just project your 3D profile and you find the surface one and you fit it, you see that, you basically plot it, you find that it really sits on top of what was observed by these guys in the 21 centimeters. So the bottom one shows you something called covering fraction of DLAs. You can see the observations are not really rich. There's just a couple of them. They're kind of sparse. This essentially measures for you how much of a DLA you're going to impact for a particular impact parameter. So impact parameter is just how close you are to the center of the galaxy or DLA. And the covering fraction is just telling you what kind of cross-section you're sensitive to. So this is a measurement. These measurements have been done by simulations and several DLA groups, but not too many, mostly at very large impact parameters. But for a good range of model predictions, they do align very well with the data. So that's another thing which comes out of the box.
What does that mean? Sorry.
Yeah, what that means to you? Yeah.
So, so you have some quasar with some DLA.
That's right.
And now the impact parameter is distance to what exactly?
That's right. So, you have a line of sight, and there is a quasar in the background like a torch, and there is a DLA system or a galaxy or a proto-galaxy or whatever it is that's absorbing the quasar light in between, and this. And basically, the way you observe this DLA, if suppose a profile has been very diffuse, then it will take you, you need a very small impact parameter to get that kind of column density. So DLAs are 10 to the 20.3 or more. So you will need
the sizes you were talking about, well, like kiloparsecs.
That's right.
But your x-axis is like hundreds or thousands of kiloparsecs.
That's right. So these are actually simulations, so sort of simulation phenomenological models, which sort of say, okay, you know, depending on what we observed, we are kind of, if we impacted at that kind of radius, about 100, then we would observe a covering fraction. So that's why the covering fractions are so small. So the covering fraction sort of goes down with impact parameter, because as you observe at higher and higher impact parameters, you won't be sensitive to the kind of column densities, which will be 10 to the 20.3 or more.
Why is it not zero? I mean,
It's very close to zero. That's right. It's very close to zero. I mean, it's almost. I mean, these error bars are kind of where they matched it. It's almost close to zero. But when you have, for example, something like a covering fraction of like parameters of really small, like about whatever, some 10 few, for example, then you will almost have a whole, like, you know, unity covering fraction, 0.8, 80%, something like that. So, I mean, the covering fraction is just one of these terms which is used to say, okay, I mean, one, this is, you know, this actually, this thing could have been a very good constraint on the DLA profile. If only we had observations at very low impact parameters, which I understand is hard because of quasar absorption line studies. I don't know what they have, but we don't have observations which are low, but they give you a very good constraint on the profile. Because if I distributed my gas in a different way, suppose I distributed with a very, very strong core and everything else being diffuse, then my covering fraction to impact parameter would go crazy. It would be very high. And then it would be low, and then it would be again. So, you know, there would be some sort of turnaround in that kind of function. But if you had a decent profile, like exponential or something which just tapers off, then the way different lines of sight will attack that profile, so how much of that DLA will you be sensitive to, will depend on how the gas is distributed.
And does clustering matter for this?
Well, these are individual sight lines, so I think it's basically intercepting. There will be something to, I mean, see, if they were tidal filaments or something, there is now just
about the galaxies live near other galaxies, so if you condition that there's a GLA here, then there's some excess probability of there being some other little tiny lump.
That's true. I think it's pretty much, but I think now it's a bit too early to say, because like I said, these are half observational, half this Fumagalli and all are sort of, you know, simulation-based measurements. So
your model is just a spherically symmetric.
That's right. That's right. It's, we don't have, the data don't warrant anything more complicated. Even with this, we're pushing like the evidences to their optimum. So that's right. That's why. And for a statistical sample, we found, and other people found, it doesn't matter so much because the numbers are so high and they're distributed across the whole redshift range that we don't really care about little details about how much ellipsoidal they are or what kind of axes they have.
But do you have clustering in your model?
Yes, absolutely. We have clustering of both the DLAs, and because otherwise we wouldn't be able to match this measurement. This is a bias times the abundance.
But do you have satellites in your model or no?
We don't need satellites in the model because we are...
Scales,
how do we, yes. Okay, so I can give you the formalism in a second, but basically, let me see if I have it with me. So what you do, since you asked, I can just bring this up. So what we do is essentially to define a DLA cross section, which is defined by, if you have your DLAs, if you have your H1 to halo mass, then you define a line of sight and you basically look at the column density by doing an integration. And then you say what kind of S, which is the impact parameter you need to reach 10 to the 20.3, which is the DLA limit. So once you have that, you have a cross section for these DLAs. And once you have a cross section for these DLAs, you just put it into the formalism to have the dn dx, which is the incidence of these systems, like how much they are in, as a function of redshift. And then you can get the column densities, which are just one more derivative. You take another derivative with respect to H1, NH1, which is giving you essentially exactly what's being observed. Like in a particular column density bin, how many of them will you have per unit redshift? So that's just one more derivative. X is just a proxy for Z. X is something called absorption distance, and it's used observationally a lot, and that's why we use that instead of using Z. X is some H0 times 1 plus Z the whole square, something like that, which just makes things co-moving everywhere. And this is how you can essentially look at the clustering of these systems, the BDLA, the bias, by taking the dark matter halo mass bias and weighting it by the probability for these systems to host DLAs. So once you do this formalism, you already make everything in terms of the dark matter halo mass function. The same argument works for one halo and two halo terms of the H1. So you basically have a weighting coming from the H1 halo mass relation and the profile. So from the profile, you define your U of K, and that gets you the 1 and 2 halo of the cluster. I can show you more of those expressions if you're interested. Yeah, I can know, I mean, later, maybe, if you want to. Okay, all right, so let me just go on to say that this is what comes out of it. So you have, this is the mean relation, a non-unity slope, and an exponential profile. That's important because most of the previous analysis used to assume that H1 mass was proportional to halo mass. And what we found, what the MCMC threw out at us, which is very interesting, is that there is evidence for that beta, which I had mentioned a few slides ago, which is the logarithmic slope, to have a value which is manifestly less than unity. So H1 to halo mass is not proportional. There is an evidence for a sloping. And essentially, that evidence comes from the mass function of H1, which I'll show in just the next couple of slides.
H1 associated with the central galaxy?
Yes, it is. I mean, it is basically a mass-weighted H1 distribution. It's a mass-weighted halo model. So we're not...
It's weird that you have, like...
Oh, this thing, there's no, right. So I have to make a disclaimer here. About 10 to the 12, 10 to the 13, the model is essentially unconstrained by the data simply because the Schedt-Dorman mass function or whatever mass function you use cuts you off. So statistically, the minimalistic model, we don't warrant any more parameters to do various things here. There are now observations of whether, you know, for example, satellites will do something or whether the central galaxy, there's a quenching and things like that. So about 10 to the 12, 10 to the 13, the model is essentially unconstrained. That is why it looks like this, because statistically we have to just allow it to go ahead. There is definitely evidence for quenching and things like that at higher masses. But till date, the kind of observations we have in omega H1 and in the DLAs and so on don't constrain this high mass evolution because it is killed by the dark matter halo mass function really sloping down at these kind of masses. So since every single formula and every single of these bias traces will be multiplied by the dark matter halo mass function to get the observable, above something like this, you have to just say, statistically, we do this. But in reality, physically, you'll have definitely some quenching and things like that. So the knee is important. The way it evolves is important. The slope is important. But high masses, we did try, we tried different halo models where we used basically something like a high mass cutoff. We used something which moves it down, basically. And we found that that parameter could not be constrained. There was no constraint on it from the data. So in a data-driven approach, we have to just let it go.
Sure, low mass allows
yes.
to higher masses at higher redshifts.
Sort of. I mean, yeah, there is an evidence for, this is actually a virial velocity cutoff that Vc of m comma z. The Vc has something like 35 kilometers per second. And just by the scaling of virial velocity with mass and redshift, your Vc being constant leads you to pick up different mass scales at different redshifts. So if I fix Vc to 35, this is the kind of evolution of mass which will be sort of predicted from the redshifts.
So assuming it's a constant Vc cutoff.
We don't assume it. We put it when we ask it to evolve, and it doesn't evolve. Exactly. We try to make it evolve, but data does just brings down. So this is actually coming back to that point I made about the UV and about the, there are works by almost, I mean, since Martin Rees and people at 1986 and 90s, where they said, okay, H1 is probably not going to be hosted in galaxies or systems with the virial velocities less than 35 to 50. This is precisely what we find. And in fact, he makes a claim that something like 34 kilometers per second, you won't host H1, and we get 35. So that was an interesting sort of, you know, something which came out of there. And so, I mean, this is something expected by people, but it's nice to be able to quantify it. It's nice to be able to see it from the data, and it's nice to be able to put an error bar on it because that's going to be useful for the rest of it. And exponential profile is also something which was interesting because, as I said, the low redshift really favored an exponential profile. So this is how, and you can see something like, you know, as Neil pointed out, 10, 20 kpc, you see a nice where the scale factor, this is the typical size of these H1 systems. So I'm going to spend a couple of minutes just sort of pointing out that actually this model brings us more than what we put in. So that was something interesting we learned from out of this model, and which was more physical. It gives some insights about the way H1 is behaving. So the first thing is that there were, as I said, several of these models adopted in the literature in the past. There used to be models for DLAs. There used to be models for 21 centimeter. And they used to look very different. You see that the 21 centimeter models people used and the DLA kind of models are very, very different. They look very different, and they have different cutoffs and things like that. And one of them slopes down, one of them doesn't. We tried, the first thing we tried was to combine these two models and say, okay, can we do something like fitting all the data just by combining ad hoc, like at face value, these two models? And what we found is that actually you can. That model, if you just combine at face value all these different models in the literature, you fit everything, but you don't fit the H1 mass function. So things which were in the past used to always assume that H1 mass was proportional to halo mass. So you see that it used to go like this most of the time. All the models used to assume that. And this leads to this kind of thing for the mass function. And what we found is that if we really want to fit the mass function, that beta comes into the picture. So this is why beta was important. This is why the slope had to come down. Physically, you can call it feedback or something which is suppressing the H1 at high halo masses. And that really helped us to fit the mass function in a better way, as you can see over here. So this is why it's a non-unity slope, which I showed you in the previous slide. And the other thing which we found is that this altered NFW, which I was mentioning to you, the one which was very popular, could fit almost everything, but it had a problem when we looked at low redshift, column density, and mass function together. So this was a measurement which people had made with DLA-like systems at low redshift. They found that if you use exponential, the red one, you really reduce a tension which we kept observing with that other profile. So that was another reason why we found the exponential does a great job, and it's much better than the altered NFW profile. So one of the preliminary work which I'm involved in with people at CETA and elsewhere is to actually apply this to neutral hydrogen gas observations, which they're taking from. They did another intensity mapping with PARCS and 2DF in the Southern Hemisphere this time, again, just like the GBT and DEEP2. And they also have some sort of constraints on shot noise. And what I find is that you can really use this kind of approach with RSDs to model this, and it seems to match the data extremely well. So it's looking very promising. I'm going to spend only a couple of minutes on this slide, and just to tell you that essentially there is something we can do with these kind of observations in the light of what people did with galaxies. And people did what is called abundance matching. So that is to say, okay, we take every halo and we take every galaxy and we sort of just match mass to mass. And we were asking the question, can we do this with H1? And we found that we could. And it allows you to quantify some very interesting scatter and things like that in the relation, and also tie it up to star formation and other observables like stellar mass to H1 mass and how that evolves. So this is where the forecasting comes in. So using this HALO model allows you to also beat the astrophysical systematic, so to speak, and say, okay, suppose we have all these priors on the H1 observables, just as we have for the CMB priors or Planck priors on the, for example, the cosmology. We can build a combined model of the cosmology and astrophysics, which will be measured in future surveys. And in so doing, the absolute numbers don't matter. But what's important is that with astrophysics and without astrophysics, there is a change in the kind of constraints you get. And if you marginalize over the astrophysics, obviously they will degrade. But what we found is that for various of these experiments, including CHIME and several others, the constraints improve and they overcompensate for this degradation, just because we have lots of tomographic redshift bins. So that's good news. It says that even though astrophysics causes the systematic, the sheer information, we use Fisher matrices here, which is coming from different redshift bins, allows you to alleviate it almost completely, in fact, completely, from big surveys like this for H1.
Sorry, what is relative error in NS? I guess I'm gonna understand that the question.
Oh, this is this. It should be very low.
Okay.
So basically, it's good that if you see SKA and other things, it's less than about 10%, 5%.
So,
you should look at the asymptote, not at the, I mean, so this is at the asymptote, we combine all the information in all these bits.
But the meaning of the y-axis is what?
Okay, I'm sorry. So basically, the meaning is delta NS by NS, how much of uncertainty you get in this, for example, NS parameter.
So you're saying the best is like, a few percent or?
Oh, the absolute number, you know, it is a function of systematics and things. This is only meant to be a relative comparison.
Okay.
So what it's supposed to show you is that for experiments which have very low tomographic coverage, the relative error you get is pretty high as compared to if you have a huge, huge relative coverage.
Because, I mean, we know NS from like
1%. Exactly. We still don't have that kind of accuracy with H1, it seems. No, it's not going to be that much until maybe SK2, probably. That I can say, probably. It's not as close to Planck, no.
Wait, that's the actual error on NS, or that's the excess, that's the degradation in the error bar coming from the astrophysics?
Oh, both are plotted. So without astro prior and fixed. So you can see that there's a bold one and there's a thin one. So if you fix the astrophysics, obviously you get a smaller error. And if you marginalize over the astrophysics, you see the astrophysical systematic kicking in. Is that clear?
Relative.
Oh, relative is just because it's delta NS by NS. Fractional. Yeah. It's not relative to another parameter. No, I'm sorry if that's confusing. It's just delta NS by NS. Yeah. The percentage error, so to speak. Yeah. So let me shift gears in the last maybe 5 or so minutes and tell you that these kind of techniques can be used for other lines, which are for extremely important in the ISM and also for reionization, which is the first one is this carbon monoxide set of lines, a ladder of states, which the CO molecule has. And that's important because it allows us to do various interesting things. Just like H1 intensity mapping, CO intensity mapping has been done. And this has a telescope which was used, and I am part of a collaboration for POMAP, which is hoping to measure the CO intensity around redshift of 2 to 3. So carbon monoxide has very interesting transitions at different frequencies. And what I did in this paper was to say, okay, if we have all the constraints which is on CO and we kind of combine them, at redshift 0, you have individual objects, just like in the halo model, you have a luminosity function. At redshift about 3, you have this intensity mapping. Can we do what we did for H1? Can we combine this to, you know, a functional form which will transcend redshifts and see how we can predict the CO luminosity? And it turns out we can. You can fit the luminosity function and the intensity mapping constraint by using functional forms which are similar to the star formation rate evolution. So that is where it's inspired from. So you have the way the stellar mass to halo mass works is similar to this kind of double power law. And you find that you can get the CO luminosity to halo mass. And you also find that you can get power spectra, which will come into importance in intensity mapping experiments. What is interesting is that you predict that there is, because of this intensity mapping experiments, there's evidence for a lot more CO at redshift 3 than originally assumed. So that was interesting. And what you can also do is to extend this to redshifted C+. So C+ is an interesting molecule, it's an interesting ion. It's the singly ionized carbon, and it arises in what are known as photon-dominated regions, or PDRs, photo-dissociation regions, as we called in the past. And basically, with processes with photoelectric effect and so on in this ISM, there are two fine structure levels of the C+ ion, and these two fine structure levels are separated by an energy equivalent to about 158 microns. And what happens is that when the C+ can arise in several phases of the ISM, can arise in neutral or in ionized, it's the brightest observable line, this 158 micron. This is shown here. So there are different lines, and they've been worked out how bright they will be observable at. It seems to be very less affected by foreground as compared to H1, where it's a relatively clean observation. It's very connected to star formation rate. You see this on the right-hand side. this is C2 luminosity with star formation rate. And you see that at low redshifts, this is the blue line is what was what was measured. And at higher redshifts, you see it's also still the same slope kind of line. So there has been a tentative detection of C+ around redshift of 2.6. They cross-correlated Planck 545 gigahertz maps with BOSS quasars and CMOS galaxies to get to isolate the C+ signal, and they found a 3-sigma constraint. That's their latest paper. So they've been doing this for a couple of years, and they found this latest constraints on the intensity of C+ at redshift of 3. And again, I explored how I can use that along with the observations of the star formation rate. So it's a little more tricky because C+ is connected to star formation rate. So you introduce another free parameter there called alpha and see how you can fit all the data. Turns out that with that detection, assuming that it is a detection of C+, and the low redshift observations, we can fit this pretty well. And that gives you a way to predict for future experiments of C+. So this is the C+ luminosity to halo mass, just like H1 to halo mass. And here are constraints on the power spectrum, which you'll measure in several experiments. And here are some of the SNR ratios, which you will get for various of these experiments, which I detailed on the first slide. So the ALMA Atacama Large Millimeter Array will go on to pencil beam surveys of this. And so will a bunch of other intensity mapping experiments, some of which are CCATP is being led partly by Canada. And there is there are some interesting prospects for SNRs for C+. And what you can do is to really predict them in a data-driven way without introducing any simulation bias and say, from the current data, this is what it looks like for intensity mapping of C+. I'm going to end with a couple of prospects for reionization, how we can use all of this in that broader context. The first thing is, like I mentioned, I'm part of this ALMA collaboration to do these pencil beam surveys for the C+ molecule, for the C+ ions. So you have different configurations, and you can do an ultra deep survey, an ultra deep field is what they call, and place some interesting constraints on the C2 from something which is actually tuned to observing individual objects, the ALMA. And also, like I mentioned, the CO map is going to have different phases, more phases 2 and 3. What is interesting is that since CO has this ladder, the kind of the at a particular frequency interval, so between say 30 to 32, you'll pick up CO10 from redshift 2 to 3. But you'll also pick up CO21, which is another transition, at a higher redshift, just because of a J into J plus 1, which is compensated by 1 plus Z. So the same frequency channel just picks up different transitions. And you can use another channel at lower frequency to cross-correlate and isolate the high redshift signal. So that is one of the aims of COMAP, to really isolate the CO signal at a point where we haven't observed anything in H1. These tracers look extremely promising to put priors on the kind of galaxies we'll see, the kind of H1 observations we may make with SKA and its precursors at really hitting the epoch of reionization. And finally, this opens up some possibilities for SNRs to do with different models, like, you know, what kind of reionization scenarios are advocated, what kind of SNRs different models predict, and what we can constrain. And in the context of H1, all this ties into really beating the astrophysical systematic as much as we can at these high epochs, some of which has been explored in one of the chapters on this white paper, which we edited a few months ago, called with the ambitious title, Fundamental Physics with the SKA. So can we do fundamental physics at cosmic dawn and reionization with all the astrophysics? And multi-tracers approach seemed to suggest that it may be possible. Okay, so I'm going to just end with a summary and prospects for the future. I've told you that there's a HALO model framework which is data-driven and can be used to interpret future observations of H1 with different surveys. You can do forecasting to investigate this astrophysical systematic, and there are interesting prospects to do more cosmological things, more physics-oriented things with this, and just because you can beat that. You can extend this. I've shown you how to extend this to other tracers and see how this all fits together to broadly address intensity mapping. You can probe the epoch of reionization. These tracers are giving us clues today to epochs which haven't been probed in 21 centimeter, and which many observational cosmologists would call the final frontier of our observations. And you can extend the HALO model with RSD and other things to really look at the high Z observations and DLAs better. Finally, you can do what you can model cross correlations in a very systematic way with the help of this HALO model. You can see how basically different observations and different of these constraints, different tracers, really tie in with each other and where the degeneracies lie, and in so doing, model things which can be used in conjunction with LSST, DES, DESI, the cross correlations with really wide field galaxy traces. Stop there. Thank you very much. More questions?
Given the time, does anyone have any, maybe one or two questions for Hamza, or could just go to lunch as well? Takers?
He said 12:30, so maybe we have 5 minutes. But maybe that was a bit just anticipating more.
But we're all going to go for lunch, so then we can ask some questions.
Thank you. Thank you.